Jade Holliday in conversation with the acclaimed writer Ta-Nehisi Coates at a November 1st event organized by the Palestine Festival of Literature at Union Theological Seminary here in New York. The discussion was moderated by the civil rights attorney and author Michelle Alexander. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, and Emily Anderson. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's Folk Music Programs.
Rise them up, KBOO 90.7. You don't know it's your girl, Tasha T.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Beyond Your Front Door, your adventure guide to the Oregon coast. I'm your host, Dina Pavlis. I'm pleased to be back in the studio today with author, linguist, and teacher, Patricia Wearat Phillips. Patty will be sharing about the many indigenous languages found along the Oregon coast and sharing some interesting history and great stories along the way. Patty, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
I'm really excited to have you back here to talk about some of the languages of the coastal indigenous tribes here. Before we jump in, can you share a bit about your background?
Yeah, I was born in Coos Bay, lived there until, till I went away to Oregon State University when I was 20. And I studied biology at Oregon State, so that was fun. And then as I was wrapping up my bachelor's in biology, I was very curious about the languages because throughout the 80s, my dad had been collecting lots of papers relating to the history and culture of the tribes, including a lot of papers about the languages, because starting back in, I think it was 1856, and then continuing up until sporadically modern times now, there had been ethnographers and linguists and occasionally, you know, amateurs kind of given a task by someone to try and collect the language. And so I looked at some of the language materials, especially ones made by a very eccentric linguist, John Peabody Harrington, who is famous for having awful handwriting and paranoid, hiding his materials, and also very talented. He was quite the character. So he also had his own idiosyncratic ways of writing down the languages. I would look at these papers and I wanted to try and learn the languages, because in my lifetime, I had never heard anyone speak the languages. Mm. I have since learned in the last few years that actually some of my older cousins do know some words, but no one had used them around me. And my dad had been removed from his native mom when he was quite young, so we just didn't have that, you know, in our household.
Right.
And it kind of dawned on me that, you know, if I was ever going to make heads or tails out of these papers and be able to say words, much less sentences, I'd need to study linguistics. So I did a crazy thing and signed up for grad school at U of O. And then, you know, years later, when I got interested in ethnobotany, you know, trying to pull together like the cultural uses of plants, one aspect of that is language. So I thought it was a pretty handy bit of background education to have, to rely on what, you know, biological training I'd been able to have and linguistic training to help me pull all that together. So for the last few years, my cousin Anna Helms and I have been working on teaching languages. We also were able to meet with several elders and document people who knew words. So that's been great. So that means, you know, we're still able to do a bit of ongoing language work, as well as compile all the voluminous materials from the last century and a half.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Well, my next question was, how did you become interested in linguistics? But I feel like maybe did we already answer that, or should I ask you that question?
Yeah, kind of. I don't even really know why, but from the time I was very young, I was just very curious about language, because at some point I realized that obviously, you know, the native people here were not speaking English, you know.
Right.
And at that time, back in the 70s, when I was a wee little thing, there weren't really any resources out there that I'd ever seen or heard. They existed, I just wasn't familiar with them at all. And it was the pre-internet era, so it was a lot harder to track these things down, you know. So I was just very curious. And then when my dad was collecting these materials in the 80s and I was looking at them, it just made me even more curious. And yeah, so studying linguistics was my way in to try and understand all these materials. And it's been an adventure, because at this point in my life, I have been able to understand a lot more than I thought I ever would be able to, especially with Saisla. I'd long kind of avoided Saisla because it's not an easy language.
Oh, interesting.
It's got something like, I don't know the exact number, but it's easily got 100 suffixes.
Wow.
And you can combine them. So you can get these lovely long words with lots of moving parts. There was a linguist who'd written a grammar of it a century ago, and occasionally I'd look at that grammar and I'd be like, oh my, that's a bit overwhelming, and I'm not sure I have the brains to
so
work with this. But luckily, you know, now we can work with some other linguists who can actually kind of understand this stuff, and I'm actually understanding more of it now than I ever have before in my life, so that's fun. And I think Saisla is a very pretty language, actually.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much, but I've heard a little bit, and it is, I think, beautiful. Speaking of all of these different indigenous languages, how many indigenous languages are there in Oregon, and which ones have you focused on the most in your work?
Yeah, I am not sure of the exact number. It's quite a lot. And of course, it depends, too, on whether, as the saying goes, one is a lumper or a splitter, which is like, you know, trying to track down that sometimes fuzzy line between what is a dialect versus a language, because dialects are just mutually intelligible versions of the same language.
Oh.
And some people can draw that line in somewhat different places. But basically on the Oregon coast, you could probably say there's about 8 different languages right on the coastline.
Mm.
At the north end, we have Clatsop, which was a lower Chinookan language. And then, well, not technically exactly on the coast, but a little bit inland is Klatskanai or Tlotskanai, which is an Athabascan language. And that's really interesting because Athabascan originates out of the far north, like Alaska and Canada. Something happened a couple millennia ago.
Yeah.
Some bad winters or something. And several Athabascan-speaking communities moved south. And some wound up in Oregon and California, and some wound up in the American Southwest. Navajo and Apache peoples are Athabascan. So it's a pretty large and pretty far-flung family, and there happens to be one island of them in the north, up by the Chinookan folks. And then you have several bands of Tillamook people. some of the place names still on water maps actually come from the Tillamook language, like Nehalem and Nestucca and Salette. All that's anglicized versions of Tillamook names. Tillamook belongs to the Salish family, which is a pretty widespread family in the Pacific Northwest. Tillamook is supposed to be, as far as we know, the southernmost representative of that language, but a lot of Western Washington languages are Salish, and there's some interior Salish languages in Idaho and Montana. And then on our part of the coastline, you've got the mystery box, which is basically Alsi and Yukwena are the same language. So the languages from, you know, where Newport is today, Waldport, the Yahats community, those folks all spoke the same language. And it's not super closely related, but probably distant related to the language. It's typically called Sayusla. And actually, there's two major dialects of that language. So on the Sayusla River is the Sayusla dialect. And then the Lower Umpqua people spoke the same language. There's a few small differences between them. One interesting one is that some Sayusla words have an L, where the Umpqua counterpart uses an N. Mm. You have words like, say, for a spring or a well, in Sayusla it's Palu, but in Lower Umpqua it's Panu. And then sometimes they have different words entirely for things like, to say it's raining in Lower Umpqua, you'd say Hinikya, but in Sayusla it's Etuit. Mm. But they could understand each other. And then Coos Bay is another oddity in that there's two languages spoken on the bay, Honus and Miluk. They have a lot of similarities, but they also have some significant differences. Why are they on the same bay? Yeah. Why are they like that? Part of it might be just they were in continuous contact with one another, you know. So these languages every day were influencing each other. And so all these languages, Miluk, Honus, Sayusla Umpqua, and Alsi Yukwena, have been kind of put in the box Coastal Oregon Penutian. So linguists for a long time have thought they're all related to each other, albeit not closely. People who work on Salish have also told me they seem to have a pretty deep Salish influence, which isn't surprising because of centuries of trade and contact. So it can be really hard sometimes to tease apart, well, what are the influences in the language that just come from borrowing, you know, from their linguistic neighbors versus coming from the same ultimate origins thousands of years ago. That's pretty fuzzy and still a puzzle to be worked out. And then to the south, there is a whole bunch of Athabascan languages. So basically from the Upper Coquille River all the way south into California to Smith River, it's just a one long dialect chain of Athabascan.
That's so interesting to me. Well, one of the things I'm curious about is how much of our Oregon Coast indigenous languages do you think have been lost?
Well, some certainly don't have much in the way of good documentation. The one that had fluent speakers the longest was actually the Southern Oregon Athabascan languages. But over time, you know, because of official government policy and boarding schools and such, people stopped teaching them to their children because they didn't want them to suffer for speaking something that was obviously not English. Now we're at a point where, you know, we want to revive these languages, because they are a big part of, you know, carrying culture and our identity. And so there are people working on several of the languages. I mean, we're working on, you know, Miluk, Honus, and Sayusla. And what's fun is there's descendants of those language speakers at Salette and the Coquille tribe. So for some of our classes, we've actually had students from those other tribes to work on rebuilding, you know, speaking communities.
Do you find the languages that people are working on can be put back together, or are there just going to be holes that will be in those languages?
Well, it is kind of complicated because, yeah, we have run into holes. Basically, there's kind of like the language as it was recorded, and then there's trying to create words for the modern times. You know, if you need a word for computer or electricity or all those kind of things, and there's different ways to go about that. One is borrowing, which is pretty common, where you borrow a word from another language or you coin a word. So yeah, as we go for building dictionaries, we kind of have to make a note like, okay, so this here is a word that was recorded, but this word here is one that we coined or borrowed. I mean, we're still pretty in the early stages of this right now, and we have created a language committee to kind of help navigate some of this and sort of settle on like, okay, what are we need a word for this thing. what are we going to call the thing?
Right. I'm just so happy to hear that this work is being done. I just think it's so important. And you mentioned that preserving the indigenous languages is really important culturally. And I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit more on that.
A lot of what's in a language reflects the culture. So kind of expressing how a culture views the land or the other living things that they share it with, or cultural practices, because, you know, there can be a word in the language for something that doesn't really exist in English, just kind of a cultural concept or something. That'll be a long, ongoing process. There is another native language that's fun that a lot of people learn. It's the most popular. It's a Chinook jargon, Chinook Wawa.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the old trade language that's kind of based on, well, pretty heavily on the Chinookan languages of the Columbia River, and also a fair bit of Salish and Waukeshan languages from further north in it, and then later added quite a lot of English and French. And it's actually the language they've been teaching at Grand Ronde Reservation for a while, because so many different tribes were put there that spoke completely different languages that Chinook Wawa became the language of the reservation there for a couple generations. And actually, Lane Community College has had a class now for a few years where you can learn Chinook Wawa. So that's actually a pretty fun class to take, because it kind of gets your feet wet, you know, wading into the water of learning how to say some of the sounds that are pretty common in Pacific Northwest languages. But you also can start to understand, like, what a lot of the local place names mean that come from Chinook jargon words.
Yeah, and you know, some of the sounds definitely are different. And do you find that any of those, are there stumbling blocks for people that are trying to learn?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, what are some of the ones that people struggle with the most?
Sometimes it's the fault of our writing system, because we use a letter X to stand in for a raspy H sound, which isn't part of modern English. And there's not like a really neat way to represent that, you know. German, I think they use a CH, but of course English speakers will read that as a ch.
Right.
Yeah, and so we've been using X for the ch, but people sometimes will read that as the English X, you know, x. Some folks have struggled with the silent L. We have ways to teach that. Basically, you know, it's not too difficult, just a little quirky, where you shape your mouth just like you're going to make a normal L sound, you know, like la, la, la. Only instead of using your vocal cords, because in English, you use your vocal cords to make that L sound, you just blow air.
Oh, interesting.
And there's a more fun version with the where you add a T, so you get tla. And that's a really common sound, but a lot of people want to change it to a KL. But so it takes practice to kind of get comfortable with making these sounds, you know, like tla, tla, kha, and things like that. And those sounds are all very common in a lot of Pacific Northwest languages. English, not so much.
Yeah, I could see that would be hard for people at first. When I read your ethnobotany book, you talk a little bit about some of the language in there, which is what piqued my interest for this show. And you were explaining how to look at some of those letters and how they would sound. And it was definitely different than I anticipated.
You know, we try and make sound recordings as well, just to kind of help people, because reading it is one thing, hearing it is something else altogether. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things I've learned from you that has been fascinating to me are the names of some of the lakes and other geographic features in our area. And I was wondering if you could share some of the names here on the Central Coast in their original indigenous language.
So it's pretty nice, because, you know, in so many cases, the names of geographic features got replaced by an English name, in some cases by a very painfully dull English name. But we still have names. They're anglicized, but they do come from the native names, like Tackenich Lake, Silt Coos Lake, Kleewox Lake, and Wohink Lake. And Tackenich originally is pronounced Tochenich, and it's supposed to mean many arms, not quite in the sense of arms, like, you know, our limbs, but like something running out in many different directions, which is a pretty good description of the shape of the lake.
Yeah.
Silt Coos originally is Chilt Coos.
Chilt Coos.
In the native pronunciation. Unfortunately, I have not been able to figure out an etymology. You know, sometimes I can by looking at the vocabularies we have recorded and figuring out how the different pieces of the language work and fit together. Chilkoos is still a mystery to me, but it is the original native name. Also, interestingly, the creek there was the traditional boundary line between the Hoich band, the Lower Umpqua people, to the south, and then the Shoshtla, Saisla people, to the north. And then there's Kliwaks, which is Tritwach, and not quite sure what it is. Harrington was really curious about place names, so when he was interviewing people in 1942, he asked about these names, and they were like, well, you know, I'm not really sure. It sounds sort of like Kliwawach, you know, they have come, but I'm not sure if that's the ultimate derivation of Tritwach Lake. And then there's Wohink Lake, Wachanik, and yeah, they weren't sure what it meant, and I haven't figured out what it meant.
Interesting.
Yeah, then Clear Lake, the big one that's just south of Reedsport by Highway 101, that I guess is the city of Reedsport's drinking water. That one has a name, Punawauchan, which I don't know what it means. It might be related to the word for mole, which is Puna Puna, but I'm not sure.
Interesting.
And sadly, yes, this fun name Punawauchan got replaced by Clear Lake, which I have complained to a lot of people has to be one of the most deadly dull names one could have for a lake. And at one point, historically, so this is fun. So these names, as they are in their modern day forms, Takanich, Silkus, Kliwaks, and Wohink, were written down in the 1850s by a surveyor. Because in that particular moment in time and in that area where he was working, there weren't any white settlers. Okay. So there weren't any English names on the landscape. And he had learned Chinook Walla, and he hired some Lower Umpqua men to help him carry his equipment. So along the way, as he worked, occasionally he would write down their names for places, including these lakes. And he wasn't a linguist, so he didn't get it exactly right. But he's in the ballpark. You know, Takanich, Sochanich, pretty close. And so luckily those names stuck, because at various points there were other alternate English names for these places that, in my opinion, are pretty dull.
Yeah.
Like Takanich at one time was sometimes known as Five Mile Lake.
Ugh.
Oof. That's got no personality.
I agree.
And then to make life painfully confusing, at times Silkus Lake was called 10 Mile Lake, which is irritating because there's another 10 Mile Lake at Lakeside.
Yeah.
And that's not that far away, so that would have been confusing. Kliwaks Lake was known as Buck Lake. And if I remember right, Wohink was also known as the Deadly Dull Clear Lake. I'm so glad the old names kind of beat out these really dull names.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, and I know there's odd stories that have grown up around some of the lake names. Like, I think Kliwaks people think means paddlewood or something, which it doesn't. Yeah, it might possibly be related to the verb to arrive or to come, but paddle would be like kliti. You know, so that doesn't really
not
sound
close.
Much like Kliwaks.
Yeah, and Silkus people get confused because the Forest Service has a trail there named Chief Silkus. And so people think it's, in fact, I thought when I was working on the quest there, I reached out to Jesse to ask who was Chief Silkus, you know, so I could write something about it, and found out there was no Chief Silkus. It's fictional.
That we know of. Now, one quirk about the old school chiefs and villages is it was very common for the head man of a village to be referred to by the name of that village.
Okay.
But yeah, we don't have any stories that come down to us of someone living at the lake or the creek who is known as the head man of Chilkoos. So, yeah, I'm not really sure where that story comes from. But basically, the common thing was the name of the person came from the village that they were head man of, not vice versa.
Right.
Yeah, like the name of the place predates the person. But yeah, I've never quite figured out exactly where that story of Chief Silkoos comes from.
So, Patty, we are just about out of time, but I was wondering if you could teach me a couple words before we go.
Sure. Which ones would you like?
Something that you think I maybe won't completely fail at. Or maybe like a hello or a please or a thank you or something like that.
Well, you know what's fun in Shoshtla Huich, hees or hisa covers a lot of ground. So hees means like good, well, fine, thank you. Hisa is like it is good.
Okay.
Oh, and can also mean beautiful, like it's beautiful. So hees, you can use that for a lot of situations.
So hees.
Mm-hmm. Hees, H, and then the E sound S.
Hees. Yeah. And then hisa.
Yeah, and that's kind of like it is for a few words.
Okay.
Yeah, hisa, it is good.
It is good. I like that.
How to say hello, like literally means how are you?
Okay.
So the most common way of saying that to one person, because there's a ton of pronouns in Seisla, more than English has. It's really fun. Nishanach.
Nishanach.
Yeah, Nishanach.
Nishanach.
Yeah, so that's like, how are you, if you're talking to one person. If you're talking to a group, so three people or more, you could say, Nishchi. How are y'all?
Nishchi.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I love this. Well, hees, Patty. I appreciate you teaching me these words. That's great. Thank you so much. We are just about out of time, and I'm wondering if there's anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up.
Well, maybe a few other place names.
Yeah.
Casita Head, they say, is one of the most photographed places on the Oregon coast.
Yes.
It has a name.
Okay.
Kshuis. It's got that silent L at the start, so it's that Kshuis. Yeah. Sadly, I have not figured out an etymology for it, but it's the traditional name of the place. And there is a story that Jesse tells sometimes that took place there, the story of the five grizzly bear brothers. And the five grizzly bear brothers actually used to live at Tliach, which is Sutton Creek. So when you pass by Tliach, Sutton Creek, just imagine long time ago, five scary grizzly brothers used to live there. Believe they don't anymore.
How does that relate to Casita Head?
Well, the first people wanted to get rid of those mean brothers because they were very dangerous and they ate people all the time, which you can imagine didn't go over well with everybody else. So they built a great big stone wall, which is now the cliff there. And they planned on tricking the brothers into thinking there was going to be a big game there, like a climbing game. And so they lured the brothers one by one into playing. And as they struggled to reach the very top, each brother got knocked on the head, and the first four were killed, fell down into the water. The fifth brother was very cautious, and he was able to dodge the club, and he swam away. And that last brother swam north and then crawled out on the beach by Waldport, and he was in a pretty bad mood. And luckily, a little old Wren woman had a house there, and she recognized him, so she was able to polish off the last evil grizzly bear. So now, no more grizzly bear brothers, but that's why the cliff is there. Is the first people, the first animal people built that place.
I love
long
that.
Long time ago, just to get rid of the scary grizzly bear brothers that were eating people.
I'm so glad you shared that, because I actually had a question to ask you about Casita Head Light Station, but I wasn't sure if I was going to have time, and so I had omitted that question. So I'm so glad that you told me that story, because as a volunteer there, I would love to be able to reshare that story. I think it's fabulous. It does make me wonder, did we used to have grizzly bears in Oregon area? Interesting.
Oh, yes. It's kind of fun in the Seisla and Hanuskoos language. It's the same word, swash. Swash is grizzly bear. In Seisla, the word for black bear is t'i.
So different.
We did used to have them. Supposedly, they especially like to hang out by Loon Lake because they used to be camas that grew there. And the bears would actually dig up camas bulbs and eat them. There's also a story of a man, this probably happened, I'm guessing, in the 1840s, 1850s, somewhere in that window, of a man who had a gun, and he was with the people who were there gathering camas, and grizzly was doing what it usually did, making its own piles of camas, and they told him, just leave the bear alone, but he had this gun, and he felt cocky. He's like, I'm not scared of this bear. So he foolishly approached it and shot at it, and he only succeeded in making the bear angry. So he got mauled, but survived. But they say it took about a year for him to heal. But yeah, that happened up by Loon Lake, probably the Ash Valley area. I don't know if camas still grows in there today. If there's any folks who have spent time in Ash Valley, I'd really be curious to know if camas does pop up there, you know, in the spring or early summer.
Yeah. Wow. I love the story. That's great. Thank you very much for sharing that. And I learned something new. I never knew that we had grizzly bears here. So.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, basically in our traditional stories, when a grizzly bear character appears, there's going to be bodies.
Okay.
they're always kind of like this ogre-like character in the stories.
Yeah. So interesting. Well, Patty, I hate to say that we're out of time. I so enjoy speaking with you always, and this has just been such a great interview. I really appreciate all of the time and information that you've shared. Thank you very much for taking time to be here today.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on. Hisa.
Hisa. That's right. I could have used my word, and I didn't. Okay. Hisa, Patty. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I've been speaking with author, linguist, and teacher Patricia Werat Phillips. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find the entire show on SoundCloud.com on my Beyond Your Front Door Oregon playlist. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations for airing this show. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
I'm a KBOO.FM. Them should know it's accurate. Kabaka Pyramid say watch your step, you know what I mean?
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. This September, the Coast Range Association, along with partners like 350PDX, Indigenous Environmental Network, Rainforest Action Network, the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, and many more, organized a major protest and counterconference in response to the Who Will Own the Forest Timber Investing Conference in Portland. If you aren't familiar with Who Will Own the Forest, I'd encourage you to listen to the episode we did a couple weeks back with Brenna Bell of 350PDX, which you can find by searching for Coast Range Radio on any podcast.